Hello, Bill.
Good morning, Matt.
Welcome, everyone, to the DMZ. Good to be back.
Now, if I see you correctly through my technological video portals, you seem to be proud of one of your local sports teams right now.
Well, you know, you got to represent, Bill, and I am representing. I'm from Maryland. Rooting hard for the Orioles, and you know the Nats have now been eliminated, so you can't really. I mean, the Redskins suck. The Nats are done. So I say,
do we just hate the Redskins now? I mean, it has the whole name thing just turned the whole city off of the Redskins, or is it just that the team is bad?
Oh, it's just that they keep losing. It's got no, the name's very pretty much irrelevant as far as I can tell. But no, they suck. They really suck, And the worst part is, it's sort of like the Washington Redskins are going through what the country is going through, which is that we had this hope that finally things would get better, and they haven't. And in fact, I think we've kind of lost hope. And, you know, I was a big, early on, I was a big sort of RG3 booster. And of course, he's, you know, first season, he was amazing. And then he got injured, and you know he's out again. But just I think we've kind of the notion that he is going to come back and be the savior for the Redskins. I think everyone's given up on it, and it's really unfortunate when you know Monday night they lost to the Seattle Seahawks, and you see Russell Wilson, a quarterback who is very similar to RG3, kicking butt. And it's sort of just rubbing it in our faces that like we could have been enjoying what the Seattle Seahawks are enjoying, and yet we are not. We are, I think, 1-4. It's to the point now where Bill, I don't even have to worry about seeing the games. It's a relief for my wife that she doesn't. You know, now we have to sort of.
Do you have free Sundays now? You actually you don't sit the all day in front of the TV. You get out to the family.
I get out. We had a big decision to make because the O's are playing Saturday night at 4. And that totally, we always go out, we like to go out to dinner on Saturday nights. And that kind of messes it up because, you know, the game could go till 8 o'clock at night or something. And I'm one of those people of a certain age that like to eat dinner a little bit earlier. So luckily it's only game
you,
2.
You like your early bird specials?
I like the early bird special, like on Seinfeld. So I think we're going to go out to dinner. It's only game 2, and hopefully I'm going to position myself where I can see like a big screen TV over some bar.
That's a big sacrifice. You're putting your family first. I respect that.
Those are the values that I believe in.
But is Washington sad about the Nationals, or were expectations really? Was that a real gut punch, or is there a sense that we're poised. Wait till next year. You know, we have the pieces in place. Blah blah blah.
No, it's upsetting, Bill, because this is the second out of two out of the last three years they have had the best record in the National League, and 2 out of the last 3 years they've gone home after the first round of the playoffs. So, you know, it's not the situation where it's an honor just to make the playoffs. No. There was expectation that this could be their year. I mean, think of it. You play 162 games, whatever, during a regular season to get to the postseason. They dominated during the entire regular season, and then you have a 5-game series. And now it's almost the entire rules and the strategy change, and it's really depressing. And on top of it, you know, the Washington Capitals have had this exact same phenomenon for many, many years now, where they do very well, make it to the playoffs, and are promptly eliminated. So it's unfortunately becoming like a Washington, D.C. thing, which is why I have, orange is the new black, as they say.
Well, in addition to you celebrating over your victorious Baltimore Orioles, you also had a star turn this week on MSNBC's Morning Joe because you had a very provocative piece up. Was it Daily Caller or The Week?
This was at the Daily Caller, which is great to spread the wealth around. And kudos to Joe for putting a little – It's great. You know, it was the must-read, Mika's must-read opinion piece, and they put the little Daily Caller logo up there, and that makes
very
my,
nice. Very
makes
nice.
Me happy.
Brand awareness. Yeah, now you are lamenting. This is interesting because on one hand, I think you are very hard-headed politically. You have a good sense of what makes for good politics and bad politics. What helps you win in the now. But you also have a deep sense of a principle. You also have a strong spiritual center. I feel like your two halves are in conflict right now, watching Republicans calibrate to have a better election year than they had 2 years ago, but sort of part of you inside is dying at the same time as the social conservative positions get buried or modulated in deference to other cutting issues. Is that a fair sense of where your head is at right now?
Well, you know me too well, Bill, because I do think that, you know, a lot of times the pieces that do well are pieces where you have really kind of come to a conclusion. But here I'm still struggling and trying to figure out what's going on. And that's part of the reason why it was at the Daily Caller and not at the Week, because at the Daily Caller I have a blog where I'm sort of fleshing out ideas. And usually, eventually, if they really mature and I go through the editing process, then they become a column. So I am sort of struggling and grappling with these things. But I also pride myself on intellectual honesty. And some of the stuff I'm seeing Republicans do strikes me, or at least say rhetorically, strikes me as very convenient and not terribly intellectually consistent.
So do you think that the convenience, because sometimes you do something in the short run that makes sense for the moment, but if it undermines some of your core principles and your brand, it hurts you long term. Are you concerned that what Republicans are doing in terms of, staying quiet on the recent gay marriage move by the Supreme Court, being more open to birth control, not defending more absolute abortion bans, are all these things things you think, look, this is just smart politics. You got to calibrate to some extent, and therefore this is not going to hurt them long run? Or do you think something is being lost that even if it works in this election, it's going to hurt them down the line?
Well, look, here's my concern, is that ideas have consequences. And when you inject ideas into the political bloodstream, even if it's for short-term pragmatic purposes, it could have long-term consequences. So when conservatives start to lose the culture, and let's take the gay marriage issue, they appear to be losing that or have lost it, and they don't grapple with it. So in other words, you really have two options, right? You could either say, we were right, we're still right, it doesn't matter what the Supreme Court does or doesn't do, we're right on this issue. Marriage is an institution between a man and a woman. Or you could say, look, we were wrong. Marriage is a very important institution. It would benefit all Americans, gays, straights. It's a kind of a salutary effect. But instead what they're saying is it's really flipping the script and saying, well, we shouldn't have been in government. The problem is government shouldn't be involved in defining it anyway. Well, that's a fine theory if you've had it all along. Like, there are some people who sort of have held that theory for a long time, and like, that's fine. I respect that, and it's a valid theory. But for people who are just sort of arriving at that now out of necessity, that seems to me to be problematic. It's escapism. And if you sort of follow through all the implications, well, if you're saying that government shouldn't be involved in these institutions and in personal relationships, then, you know, I think it's a logical conclusion to say, well, why should government be prohibiting polygamy? Why should they set an age of consent? Now, I don't want, you know, as Joe sort of tried to be my protector yesterday, and he was afraid I was going to be, you know, Santorumed, which I think could be a dirty thing. But I think what he meant was that they were going to that they were going to try to say that I was equating, like, you know, gay marriage to polygamy or whatever. But what I am saying in this instance is that if you're a conservative and you say that government has no business in deciding who can love who or who can marry whom, then that is a consequence. And that is a logical, you know, thing that would happen. And so I also think that when movements and parties, you know, when once they start compromising and conceding points, you know, where does it end? It's, you know, is it what happens when the right to life no longer becomes a convenient or politically beneficial position to take? Do we abandon that too? I would consider myself to be, you know, one of the things about, you know, conservatism and the Republican Party that I like is looking back at the, you know, the fact that it was a moral party from the beginning, you know, with abolition, and the notion that we should just sort of eschew these cultural hot button issues. I don't like that. And the last thing I'll say about it, Bill, is that all politics, you know, essentially, basically all laws, or at least most laws, are morals, values based, right? Whether there obviously are or not. It's, you know, and politics is about choices and values. And the left, to their credit, they see things this way. I mean, like, marriage equality to the left is a moral issue worth the fighting for. Equal pay is a moral value. You know, all the things that the left believes in, to them are values-based moral issues. Not all, but I mean, the vast majority of them, right? And I would say that if the Republican Party or the conservative movement all of a sudden becomes the party of, like, reason and logic, and we're not going to play the morals game anymore, then they will continue to lose, because people are motivated by purpose and calling and values. And so if the lesson, so if you're wrong, or if you're losing at the morals game, the answer shouldn't be, well, let's just not talk about values anymore. And I sense, now, it's not like this is like, this is what I dig about Morning Joe, by the way. Let me give them some props, because they had me on to talk about this really weird, nuanced thing that's not, you know, I mean, you can, this isn't like a
that's not the horse race story.
Right. But it is something I see bubbling up and that I'm sort of picking up on. You know, it was fun to talk about.
So, but if I, just so I understand you correctly, you would not be mad at the Republican Party if they all at the same time said, we are now for equal marriage rights because marriage is a social good that is healthy for society, and we want to see both gay Americans and straight Americans share this institution, because there would be a moral underpinning, a value-based underpinning for the rationale. That would not bother you. What bothers you is saying, having an amoral, strictly crude political reason to stay quiet. Am I characterizing you correctly?
Well, look, I'm a columnist, so part of my job is to attack whatever people do. Okay, first let me say, what you've just described, I think, is an entirely coherent and reasonable position. I mean, I think Andrew Sullivan was probably the first to make this point. If that happened, I would probably write a column talking about how this is a big deal, and frankly, that there would be a danger of losing social conservatives. You know, the Reagan coalition, the last element that made that a winning coalition, were social conservatives. And I think if the Republican Party, if the conservative movement were to come out strong and in a unified voice and say what you just said, there would be potential repercussions. But that would at least, I will say this, I think you could probably respect that more than what they're doing now, which is a bit of a sleight of hand move, in my opinion. And again, if you believe that government should never have been involved in condoning marriage, the institution of marriage, if it's not government's responsibility to sort of incentivize family and marriage and give special, you know, carve outs and all that stuff. Like that's a perfectly legitimate position if you've always held it. But if you 10 years ago thought that you should use the force of government to stop gay marriage and to, you know, encourage marriage, and you used to be for like tax benefits for marriage or whatever, and now all of a sudden, because you've lost, now your position all of a sudden is, well, government shouldn't be involved. It's hard for me to respect that. And I do have to point out, I think there are, if you want to be intellectually consistent on that, then you're really becoming like a hardcore libertarian, and there are consequences, you know, consistent in terms of consistency to that. Like, would you be okay with polygamy in that case? Polygamy has a long history. There is a faith component. It's something that that has existed for a long time. Other religions, you know, it could be potentially like a sacrament or whatever, at least part of their faith. So you could make a pretty good argument for it if you think that government has no responsibility or right to help define what a marriage is and what a marriage isn't.
Now, I had a piece over at Real Clear Politics about how the Republican Party is trying to reach out to women voters, which I think it overlaps with this issue. I mean, they're clearly, you know, the Republicans do like to say that these charges of us having a war on women are bogus. It's trumped up by Democrats and the media. But obviously they're worried about it because you can see in the advertising they are trying very hard to have ads that reach out to women, particularly younger women, to diffuse the attack. So they must be leaving a mark. And I'm sure part of the reaction to the gay marriage ruling ties into that fact, but certainly more overtly, the attacks on Senate candidates and gubernatorial candidates in terms of abortion positions and personhood amendments, which Democrats use to say these people want to ban birth control. Republicans are trying very hard to blunt those attacks. But some of the ads that are being used are just, you know, laughably bad. I'm not the first person to call attention to them, but I did try to tease out, you know, what is it that's so bad about them, and why is Republicans having such a hard time? Because it's not like these guys don't know how to make ads. I mean, these are professional ad makers. They've done lots of very inspired spots over the years. What about this demographic and this subject matter is bedeviling them so? You had this Crossroads ad, which Karl Rove's group that ran in Colorado, where it's four women standing around a kitchen island. And as a side note, I find Crossroads in particular always has their ads in nice kitchens, even when they're complaining about the economy. Everyone's always in a really nice house. I always find that weird, but that's a side point. So there's four women around a kitchen island, and it's all just very staged and awkward. Where this one woman says, "I want to have a real conversation about the issues. Yes, why is Mark Udall always using political scare tactics? Why did he oppose Keystone?" I mean, these are just not things that people say. And one says, "We're not single-issue voters." You know, no human being says that in normal conversation. That's what political consultants say when they talk about what kind of ads they need to draft. So the premise of the ad is to say Udall is being unfair in attacking a Republican Cory Gardner on his abortion and birth control positions, and they should be talking about economic issues, though they never actually say abortion or birth control in the ad. It's clearly implied. Now you have this other ad by Americans for Shared Prosperity, which is not specific to a race, but it's a woman, a young woman, saying that she's had this bad relationship with this man, and as it goes along, it's clear that it's Barack Obama because he's just a giant disappointment. And she says at one point, I care about more things than birth control. You know, he says he's going to give me free birth control, but he won't let me keep my own doctor. You know, that kind of thing. But the whole thing is in this context of a bad relationship. You know, she's online dating. In fact, the ad is called Dating Profile. Mm-hmm. And And there's sort of a sense that the only way to talk to these women about politics is to put it in the context of dating and relationships. Otherwise, they won't listen. And the most recent one is done by the College Republicans, which was a spoof of the reality show Say Yes to the Dress. They call it Say Yes to the Candidate. And they actually did basically identical ads for six gubernatorial candidates. And it's all in a bridal shop, and it's done in reality TV show style. And, you know, this young woman says, you know, I need to think about my budget. That's why I like the Rick Scott. You know, it has fresh new ideas that don't break my budget. And then the shrewish liberal mom wants her to have this more outlandish, you know, liberal dress with all these frills that cost too much. And I think it was Amanda Marcotte, Slate, saying, you broads like wedding dresses, right? You know, this is the way I should talk politics to you, right? It's all very ham-handed. And I ended the piece by saying you could turn back the clock, if you will, and go back to Dwight Eisenhower's campaign in 1956. In fact, Eisenhower was christened the women's candidate in 1952. He had a gender gap in his favor with women of about 5-6 points. He won both groups, but he won women by more, which was credited in large part to his pledge to end the Korean War. And even his 1956 ads, he had several women. Women-oriented spots about foreign policy and how he's kept the world peaceful. But he had a 4-minute-long ad that was also about women voters as well, that touched upon foreign policy and economic issues, as well as a lot of superficial things. I mean, I wouldn't say this was the purest ad as far as reaching the woman is concerned, but for the time, you know, there's lots of stereotypes about women being homemakers in it, which is sort of off-putting today. But what was different about those ads than today's is in all those ads, women voters spoke for themselves, particularly in that 4-minute ad. It was clear to me that they were unscripted ads. They went out on the street, they found women that liked Eisenhower, they spoke their own mind, and they took the ones they liked best and used them in the ad. The other shorter ones about foreign policy were a little more staged, but they still came across like regular women, not endorsers, and not using, you know, clunky, you know, political consultant language. And so I just don't see why can't Republicans today just find real women, and let them speak for themselves. And, I mean, even if it wouldn't, you know, solve all their problems, I just think it wouldn't be such an embarrassment. They seem to be making their own problem. I mean, the National Journal just last week said this is the biggest gender gap they've ever seen in history. You're talking 20, 30-point gender gaps, bigger than what we saw in 2012.
You want to know who else besides Ike is good with the ladies?
Who's that?
I have a column going up today about how Mitch McConnell, 72-year-old conservative man, is running against a 34-year-old woman, and I've gone through the crosstabs bill, and this has been going on for months. He is within 2 or 3 points of her amongst women consistently.
And it's really close among men too, because I know McConnell's got the lead, but it's not a big lead.
So it's close among men too. And in fact, you know, the recent poll that some think is an outlier that shows crimes ahead, the big swing were men coming to her, but not women. It's very interesting.
I think she has run that race. I think she's mentioned equal pay. I don't think, correct me if I'm wrong, anyone out there, I don't think she's run a lot of abortion and birth control related ads.
They've tried to ding. This is not an accident. They have attempted, and we'll say they, in some cases, like the Democratic Party, they have tried to make the war on women stick. I mean, think of it. It would be an obvious move to make against Mitch McConnell if you're Alison Lundgren Grimes, and it hasn't. And it's the McConnell campaign. There's actually a year and a half ago, Ashley Parker at the New York Times did a whole story about how McConnell was going to stop the war on women meme from hurting him, and he's effectively done exactly what he said he was going to do. It's fascinating that he telegraphed all the things he was going to do. And they've very aggressively pushed back on it. Seems like it has worked.
He's a big splashy ad, which tells a very personal story of a woman whose child was kidnapped in Africa, and he personally intervened to save her. It's a big emotional gut punch kind of ad. I would not be surprised if that was a huge help to him in narrowing that gap.
Right. I think it could be.
And I with my own point, an ad where a woman is talking for herself.
Yes. Yeah. Well,
using
that's a good
her own
point,
words.
Yeah.
And he's got a good story to tell there, of course, but it's not a scripted, poll consultant, ham-fisted ad.
I think you make a good point. Let me ask you this, though. I mean, Ike was before the abortion, not the abortion, Ike was before the birth control pill. It was before abortion, you know, the Roe versus Wade abortion ruling. It was before the 1960s, the sexual revolution. I mean, does it even matter?
Eisenhower did run on equal pay. Equal pay was an issue at the time, and he was foursquare for it. I didn't see him use it in the ads, but he mentioned it in both his State of the Union address in 1956 and in his convention acceptance speech. So he had that nod in there. I mean, so some of these issues I think were kind of beginning to simmer. But correct, you're not having the, you weren't in this big culture war like you were in the 60s and 70s.
Right, and so I do. I mean. The obvious, now you very well may be onto something, and it could be that McConnell, that what McConnell's doing, you know, you've got Elaine Chao, you know, his wife and the former Secretary of Labor, who is running ads, looking right at the camera, supporting him as well. You may be onto something, but I do think that the obvious criticism of your piece would obviously be that, like, you know, hearkening back to what worked for Ike, apples and oranges. It's maybe not applicable to today.
Well, I would agree that it's probably not a silver bullet. I mean, from a liberal standpoint, the obvious criticism is: look, if Republicans can't move on absolute abortion positions and on personhood amendments, you know, there's a substantive, you know, a barrier to winning the favor of young women voters. And as the National Journal piece mentions, the gender gap is really centered on single women. Republicans compete with married women. They're getting trounced with single women. So it's that demographic they're trying to reach, and that demographic that cares the most about reproductive issues, because they don't want to be pregnant yet. And I made an allusion to that in the piece. Like, look, if you either have to change your view on those positions if you're going to win those voters. But if you're not, at least you got to have an agree to disagree kind of stance and not be dismissive to people who hold that view. A lot of the theme of these Republican ads is you shouldn't care about that issue. Abortion and birth control are just not as important as jobs and Keystone.
It is interesting, Bill.
The voter decides what's important, not you.
True, but it is interesting, again, going into the crosstabs, the most recent poll that showed Grimes up, it's actually not the most recent anymore, but the recent poll that showed Grimes up, which again, some believe is an outlier, but if you look in the crosstabs, what women and men are tied for the issue they care most about. It's jobs and economy at 54%. I don't know if this is just a Kentucky thing. But you know, that is quite telling. But
I think what Republican consultants are making the mistake of, I'm sure there are poll numbers like that elsewhere. I'm sure a lot of people say push comes to shove, jobs are more important than birth control. But it doesn't mean that I don't care about that birth control isn't really important to me. So don't right. if you start lecturing me and telling me that I'm wrong for taking the issue seriously, I'm going to recoil at that. That sort of violates the customer is always right maxim. You just don't get to dictate that. I mean, maybe you can be subtle about it. Maybe you can find a way. I mean, at least the say yes to the candidate ads just talk about taxes and spending and don't even mention abortion and birth control. You know, I think you could probably do ads around that and say let the voter naturally come to that view and reprioritize that. But you can't shove it down their throat because people are going to think you're being very condescending.
So I do want to, not to be pedantic or persnickety here, but I do want to, you said something interesting, which I think is like kind of like a Rorschach kind of test thing. which is not true, but the fact that you focused on it the way you did. So you said that single women tend to vote Democratic because they are the ones who care about, you know, not getting pregnant about it. And very well may be true. But I would point out that married women are more likely to vote Republican or to be conservative because they care about things like, you know, community, school, family. There's a reason why they are also, there's a reason why there's a dichotomy, I would argue, between single women and married women. And unfortunately for conservatives, the trend is to postpone marriage and or to not get married altogether. And so that accounts for a huge, one of the huge reasons why the culture is shifting and the elections are shifting.
Although, I mean, the education issue, I think, is really big. It's one of the, you know, if we can shift away from just the culture war aspect, just get into the midterms in general, you know, on one hand, you know, you look at a lot of top line numbers. If the top line numbers hold, Republicans will probably take the Senate. But there's still a lot of tight races out there. And a number of races where people thought Republicans were going to have a better shot than they are. And in part, it's state government, Republican state government cuts in education spending have really damaged Republican prospects, particularly in North Carolina and Kansas. I know there's a piece up in The Nation that talks about other states as well. I just had to be more aware of the Senate races there. I mean, Kay Hagan has just pummeled Tom Tillis on education cuts. I mean, Tillis is trying to say, look, I didn't really cut education. I raised education funding. You know, it kind of depends on, you know, what pots of money you're talking about and, you know, relative to inflation and baselines, all that kind of thing. But the upshot is he's taken a beating on it, and it's definitely hurting his prospects. And in Kansas, the governor, we talked about this in past year, we talked about the Kansas race, you know, the governor, Sam Brownback, you know, had a big tax cut, which led to a big cut in education spending, and that's led to a rift in the Republican Party where the Republican moderates are backing the Democrat for governor and backing the independent Greg Orman for Senate. So education is an issue that, you know, women care about, you know, and you know, parents care about regardless of gender. And it raises the question, you know, does this philosophy, you know, work on the state level? And are they going to, is there a chance that they're going to, Republicans won't take the Senate, even though there's a lot of momentum going their way because of missteps made at the state level by being too pure?
Right. Well, you know, I guess what I'm getting at it speaks to the whole soccer mom phenomenon. That your priorities change and maybe security is more important. Maybe you think about things differently. But anyway, you mentioned Orman, right? And so I think that we should probably maybe conclude by talking about the weirdness taking place in places like, we've talked about Kansas ad nauseum, but now we're seeing this metastasize and spread to South Dakota.
I think, you know, South Dakota has gotten real weird because of a three-way race, and I think also there's some interesting stuff happening in Georgia. So you have these three cases. I think most people think McConnell has a steady lead in Kentucky, that one outlier poll notwithstanding. I mean, that one poll might help Allison Grimes, you know, get some money coming in and maybe keep it somewhat competitive, but you haven't seen a lot of change in that race. But, you know, South Dakota is even weirder, potentially weirder than Kansas, although it's one poll that has made people's eyebrows perk up, and maybe that's an outlier poll. But the poll that came out this week had the Republican Mike Rounds, former governor, I think it was at 35, the Democrat Rick Wyland, who is running a really, you know, progressive populist kind of race. He's only at 28, but, you know, 7 points is not insurmountable. But you have an independent, Larry Pressler, who, number one, is a former Republican senator, a three-term senator, if I remember correctly, but he endorsed Obama twice after leaving the Senate, but is now saying he's disappointed in Obama because he's too beholden to the military-industrial state, and he's running ads saying that he's disappointed in both parties, wants to work together and solve problems, and also pledging to only serve one term. The guy's 72 years old, so he doesn't necessarily need to have it be his long-term career. But he's saying, because I only serve one term, I won't spend a minute fundraising, and I can spend all my time working. And he, you know,
I thought John McCain should have done that too.
That would be what an interesting move. Bob Dole, quit the Senate with a dramatic flair to run for office, and I think that gimmick kind of petered out pretty quickly. But there is a certain faction of voters that doesn't like all the fundraising, and you're not in a situation where maybe you only need 40% or even low 30s, to win this race in South Dakota right now. So if those numbers, prove true, the race gets pretty scrambled. Now, what's extra interesting about South Dakota is, in Kansas, you have right-wing government causing a rift in the Republican Party, creating an opening for an independent. In South Dakota, Mike Rounds was not embraced by conservatives. He was considered a big spender. He raised certain taxes. I think he raised internet taxes. I think he has some pro-immigration reform leanings, although he says now he's against amnesty, of course. I get the sense that he hasn't gotten a firm base of support from his right flank there. But none of these other candidates. Well, I'm sorry, go on.
Well, I was going to say, first of all, thank you for mentioning that, because there seems to be a sense that this is a bad sign for conservatives. And, it often is the case that that it's because Republicans go squishy or moderate that they open themselves up to this sort of thing. But look, I think the really interesting phenomenon here, as Jonathan Martin wrote in a piece about spoilers in the New York Times recently, and he was on my podcast, The Matt Lewis Show, Matt Lewis and the News. You can listen to my conversation with Jonathan Martin on this. But, for a long time, third-party movements or third-party candidacies, whether it was an independent or a libertarian, were really seen as sort of fool's errands and the kind of thing that people who were just quixotic dead. And now you have to think, especially in these Republican states where running as a Democrat really is a fool's errand in many cases, that running as an independent could be a viable option. And
well, certainly it's viable now. I mean, I do wonder how sustainable the phenomenon is, because both Pressler and Orman, when you see their ads, I mean, I'm not saying they have no views or no policies at all, but their ads are really issueless. They're really just both parties suck. I want to solve problems. If these guys win, at some point you got to take votes. You got to take clear positions, and you can't play that card. You can't play that card more than once. So if there's really going to be this kind of viable, no labels, third party movement in the country, at some point you got to take stances. And these guys are they might win. They might win this one time, but they're going to win by skating. And that can't sustain cycle to cycle.
Yeah. But you could see next cycle a proliferation of candidates trying this. And who knows if it'll work again or not. But look, we have been seeing for a long, long time, the big trend is people registering as independents, millennials especially, not identifying with one political party or another. And, I'll give you an example. Like, Kansas is a prime example, right, where my instinct would have always been that Kansas would be like the last state to try to throw out kind of a good old boy, old white Republican that, just culturally these guys just keep getting elected. Now, I know there's an asterisk there because Pat Roberts has been absent. He's been AWOL, hardly ever shows up in the state. But still, you would think that it's sort of a Midwest kind of populist red state. That they would be fine with that. And now they're really flirting with this young guy who, as you mentioned, Bill, he can be whatever you want him to be. The minute he starts picking sides, he alienates half of the people. But if you're a conservative, you could believe that maybe Orman's better than Roberts. I mean, Roberts is this you know, sort of establishment old guy. And if you're a liberal, you can imagine him as being this young progressive. He is basically whatever you want him to be. And I think you do make a good point that, you know, at the micro level, you know, once these people, once these guys start taking votes, then they really do risk it, you know, alienating people. But, you know, again, could there be another fresh face, you know, who's, you know, that runs? I mean, is this going to be a phenomenon that matters in 2016? In other
words? Well, I mean, it depends on how well they do now. I mean, let's say yeah. Orman wins and Pressler wins and Angus King from Maine is already there. And no party has a clear majority, and these guys become the fulcrum of power, and they start throwing their weight around. You know, we speculated about this, you know, in our past Kansas show about how, and I was saying, I mean, maybe Orman sides with Republicans and then stabs in the back in 6 months and throws his weight to the Democrats, and Republicans are humiliated. But at the same token, these guys are selling themselves as ultimate problem solvers. It's a pretty high bar to clear because they can't single-handedly solve these problems. So If they are pitching the country, elect us blank slates, and we'll just use our good old-fashioned horse sense and bring the two parties together. And guess what? The two parties have disagreements, and you don't get to magically solve them just by showing up. That undercuts their brand. You know, you had in Italy. You had a similar kind of anti-politician movement that. That won a bunch of parliamentary seats, and then they got there, and they, you know, the way you know European politics generally work, you have to build coalitions with amongst the parliament to form a government, and that faction just refused to play. they wouldn't caucus with anybody. They wouldn't allow a government to form, and so the other parties, which actually were sort of diametrically opposite of each other, forced themselves together just so a government would form and froze out yeah. this third party movement because they weren't serious about because at some point you got to take a stand on something.
Yeah, but you know, but it is possible that there's a new paradigm. I mean, now maybe it's easier to pull this off as a mayor or a governor than it is in the Senate, where you're forced to vote on things that you don't even necessarily want to bring up. But like, consider me, Bill. I mean, I self-identify as a conservative. I'm strongly pro-life, but I'm you know, pro-immigration reform. I'm really interested in, you know, communities and walkable communities. But I'm also very interested in preserving, you know, religious liberty. I mean, these are not the hot button issues that get talked about on cable news. These are not the defining, immigration is, but you get my point. And so you certainly could cobble together like a Matt Lewis conservatism. But I guess, you know, the problem there is that if you're in the Senate, you sort of have to vote on what they put before you. I think maybe easier to put together a governing agenda philosophy if you were an executive.
Right. You have a lot more leeway to, I mean, particularly at the mayoral level when, usually your city council is pretty easy to work with, and it will be pretty compliant to whatever mayoral agenda is, because that mayor has a pretty clear mandate from a small populace. The Senate's a much different beast, you have a two-party system where there's not a lot of ideological flexibility right now on both sides. You know, but the two parties used to be more ideologically diverse, and now they've been ideologically purified for the most part. And so it's hard to cross the aisle. Essentially, the compromising is being done within the party tents, not between the party tents. But the public doesn't really get that. So the public is sort of wishing that if they vote for gridlock, that it'll force the parties to bend. When they need to, in my mind, if I can lecture for the moment, need to recognize, look, you know, this party caucus has compromised on various issues regarding taxes and immigration and whatnot, and this party has compromised on other sorts of things, and I got to say which party's compromises I like more, and vote for that one party so they can function, because otherwise the Congress is not going to function. They're not seeing it that way right now, and so a Pressler and Orman can just play the independent card. And preach problem solving. So, you know, we'll see how well it goes. I think what people should understand in South Dakota is that, unlike Kansas, there's no out-and-out fire-breathing conservative candidate. It's different shades of moderation between Rounds and Pressler, and a more openly a populist candidate in Whelan. There might be a fourth party guy there. Maybe he's more of a right winger. I'm not sure. I haven't checked out his page yet. But it does sort of again question the notion that we're experiencing a sort of conservative wave. Again, I think Republicans might win. I don't think they're winning on a huge burst of conservative momentum right now. And so I do think it's going to raise questions if they do take the Senate, how they're going to govern.
And so while we were talking here, Bill, that piece did go up. It's called "Why Isn't Allison Lundergan Grimes Beating Mitch McConnell Among Women Voters?" It's at theweek.com. Check it out. Check out my podcast, everyone. I'm pretty proud of it. It's getting. I feel like we've taken it to a new level.
Yeah, you're getting big names pretty regularly.
Yeah, and it's an interesting conversation. I just had a talk with an author about how Star Wars conquered the universe. As I mentioned, we had Jonathan Martin on to talk about his New York Times column, including one of the things we talked about were these spoilers. So check that out, everyone, as well.
And this little humble show is a podcast as well. If that is your preferred format for your listening pleasure.
Yeah. I think people don't realize that. You can listen to this. You don't have to watch it. I know we're handsome, but you can listen to it on the metro, on the treadmill, whatever, on iTunes. You can download the podcast. A lot of ways to consume Matt Lewis and Bill Scher. We are, as Rick Klein says, platform agnostic.
So we are less than 4 weeks to Election Day. I assume next week will be even more action-packed than this one. I look forward to chatting with you again.
Me too. I'm going to be keeping one eye on the campaigns and one eye on the Orioles. But we'll be right back here talking about both, I suspect, Bill, next week in the DMZ.
All right.
So, have a good one.
Take care.